Shift is brought to you by Continental. As one of the world's leading mobility suppliers, Continental is developing intelligent solutions to make driving safer, more efficient, and more connected.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to Shift, a podcast about mobility. I'm Pete Bigelow, your host. We start a new year and a new season of the Shift podcast, looking ahead to CES, which takes place this coming week in Las Vegas, and what's expected to be a return to the big, raucous, in-person event like the pre-pandemic days of old. One of the big anchors for this year's CES is the Indy Autonomous Challenge, the self-driving racing series that returns for the second straight year to the Las Vegas Motor Speedway. Competition is scheduled for this Saturday, January 7th. 9 teams are eligible to compete. One of them is led by Madhur Behel, professor at the University of Virginia who heads the school's Cavalier Autonomous Racing Team. Madhur is my guest on the podcast today. We're going to discuss his transition from racing autonomous vehicles at 1/10 scale to racing Indy cars, what he learned from crashing one of the latter at 125 miles per hour, and whether technology can trickle down from racing and make a meaningful impact on the autonomous cars operating on public roads. You can follow all the action this week, whether that's the Indy Autonomous Challenge specifically or everything else going on at CES, at autonews.com. Automotive News is going to have a team of a dozen or so on the ground in Vegas, so we're going to have extensive coverage of the entire event. To kick that coverage off, and without further ado, I'm pleased to bring you this conversation with Madhur Behel. Madhur, welcome to the podcast. It's great to have you here today.
Yeah, it's a pleasure to be here, Pete, and thank you for inviting me.
You are headed to Las Vegas for the Indy Autonomous Challenge, which is a huge part of CES. Let's just kick this off. Tell me about your role with the Indy Autonomous Challenge. What do you do as part of that?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to believe that it's almost been a year since the last race at CES. We were there in January earlier this year, and we will return in January of 2023 for a fully autonomous overtaking competition that is going to take place as part of the Indy Challenge being held at CES. So my role, I am a professor in computer science at the University of Virginia, and I'm the team principal for the Cavalier Autonomous Racing Team, which is one of 9 teams, which is part of the Indy Autonomous Challenge, which essentially is a university-wide international challenge where teams compete against each other to race fully autonomous Indy light cars at speeds of 150 miles per hour and excess with 2 cars at a time, and you have to overtake each other. So it's very exciting. We are all geared up. This is what my team has been doing for the past 6 months or more, preparing for the upcoming challenge. And we are excited to go to Vegas and start practice, a few days of practice before the final race on January 7th. Yeah.
Madhur, I'm curious, how did you get interested in autonomous racing in the first place? Obviously, it's a very relatively new field.
It is. And to answer that, we have to roll the clock back in time to about 2015, when I was exiting grad school and did my PhD from University of Pennsylvania. And for me at the time, autonomous racing was like a nights and weekends hobby. I built a 1/10 scale autonomous race car, like a RC car, which would run autonomously with some embedded computer and a small LiDAR on top of it. And I used to call it, F1/10, because it's 1/10 the scale of a Formula One car. And that became actually a very big program in the remaining 5 years. We made everything open source. So I started getting involved in autonomous racing from the smaller scale, because I felt that at the time, autonomy was not that very accessible to a lot of academic researchers, because you require large infrastructure to have full-scale cars, and you want to run full-scale cars on your university. It's a big infrastructure investment. Whereas with the small-scale car, you could run a control test and develop algorithms for perception, for planning, for control. So that's how I got started. And now to this day, there's more than 70 universities across the world which use this testbed. it's a big project called f110th.org, and anybody can go and build their car of their own. And we also started organizing these 1/10th scale Grand Prix, fully autonomous. We used to piggyback on robotics conferences, machine learning conferences, and our teams from all over the world used to come and participate there. And then in 2019, I got approached by the organizers of the India Autonomous Challenge because they had seen me organize these 1/10th scale challenges. You know, this was the sort of the big vision that I hoped were to exist someday, and they made it possible where we were given this chance that, you know, what if we do this for real now with full-scale cars, fully autonomous, with the same intent that this is a battle of algorithms, this is a proving grounds to stress test the AI for autonomous driving and see what the limits of autonomy is at full scale and on prominent racetracks all over the world. And so it was a very, very good proposition, very difficult to say no to. And without, you know, thinking twice, I committed resources and assembled a team of very sharp graduate and undergraduate engineering students. And through 2 years during the pandemic, believe it or not, teams were kind of hacking it out in simulation to prove their mettle. And at the other end of it, in the beginning of 2021, 9 teams qualified to go from the virtual to the real. And we had the opportunity to get our own full-scale car. So we have 9 cars that are completely identical. So this is not a hardware competition. And the only way you can win this competition is by designing an algorithm which is better than your competitor. And these are fellow academics. So there's a lot of, you know, collegiality here as well. And there's a lot of, you know, knowledge sharing. And collectively, the level of the competition has grown from the very first where we raced one car at a time in Indianapolis back in the fall of 2021 to now we will be racing multiple cars, 2 cars in a rule set which very closely mimics what human racing drivers do today. So that's how the competition advances slowly. We aren't quite there yet where we will have the chaos of the Indy 500 with 20, 25, 28 drivers. That's still a while out. That's really the goal. That's what drives me. In terms of pushing the research, which is at the frontier of autonomous driving. So it was that is what my journey is. And throughout this journey, there were a lot of deep research questions, which we are also answering. And so really, this is research in practice is how I see this competition. We are trying to push the frontier in the sense of what are the limits of how well you can perceive another opponent who's actually trying to inhibit your own progress. And that's what excites us. That's what drives the students. That's why we keep coming back every year to race again and again.
Yeah. How much of what we're going to see in Las Vegas is the same as what you're doing with the 1/10th cars? Like how much of is the parallel there, or because your form factor is considerably changing, how much is new and totally not applicable?
Yeah, so that's a very good way of linking the two worlds together. So, you know, every robot shares a common DNA, right? I don't care if this is a race car or a space robot or underwater robot or your Roomba, which cleans your, you know, floors. Every robot has to sense the world and plan its own actions in the world and then accordingly execute some control. In the case of a race car, it's like steering and acceleration control. And so this perception planning control has to be done, and whether it's 1/10th scale or whether it's full scale. So at the let me talk about things which transfer from the 1/10th scale. So, you know, when you have multiple cars and you have 1/10th cars that are relatively cheap to crash than a full scale car, you focus on developing algorithms that can generate safe trajectories in the chaos of many, many other agents in the track. And so those primitive algorithms, those sort of the logic for that translates pretty well, actually, to the full scale. But because on the full scale, you have the curse of complexity, right? We have to control a full scale car. The sensors are completely different. We have 3 kind of solid state LIDARs that give us a lot of dense point cloud information. We have 6 cameras. We have, 3 radars. You have 2 GPS units. So it's just the complexity of running the full scale car is orders of magnitude difficult and different from running the 1/10th scale. So I would say the 1/10th scale is a good gateway. So you learn the ropes of what autonomous racing has to offer. Why is it relevant to passenger driving? Why should you care? And how you can get started without having a full-scale car. But the full-scale car, running it safely and reliably, is the utmost exercise in engineering rigor and software engineering and development as well. And it's basically our test bed where we can try out the ideas that we believe in through simulation and small scale practice onto the real track with kind of the safety knob dialed up all the way to 11, because we don't want to crash these cars. Yeah.
Some of them have crashed over the last, year of competition. And I'm curious, like you said before, it's easy and cheap to crash the 1/10 size cars. I'm curious how the hardware has held up in some of the real crashes that we've seen in the autonomous challenge. And what have you learned about the onboard computers and sensors in terms of how robust they are in these high speed crashes?
Right. Let me prefix that by saying my team has had a very, very big crash at 125 miles per hour, right? That's one of the worst crashes that the competition has seen. So I do have some insight to offer exactly on how well these cars hold up. But before I kind of dwell upon that, I have to also inform that this is still, it was meant to be like a prototype, right? This is not, we don't have a assembly line churning out autonomous race cars, at least today. Hopefully, who knows what the future holds. So the very first year, there were actually students who designed the prototype, and we all discussed collectively what should be the choice of the sensors and the drive-by-wire system, where should it go. And there's an entire internal rig which holds all these electronic components. Right, the monocoque of the race car has zero room for a human because it's just packed with our electronics and our computers and the GPS and all the sensors that I mentioned before. And so it is, at the end of the day, still a race car. So the body of the race car is designed to crash effectively and absorb all the energy of the crash to protect the driver. In our case, the driver is the electronic bits, the expensive parts, which if damaged would cost us a lot to replace. And so when my car did spin out and just literally rammed into the wall at Las Vegas last year, while overtaking another team, because you have to remember this is racing, and in racing there is a very famous saying that if everything seems under control, then you are not going fast enough. So the nature of racing is to push these cars and find out where the limit is, and the more you can rehearse and bleed in simulation, the better your outcomes would be on track. But the electronics did hold up. They can survive a crash even at these ridiculous speeds. But having said that, the entire last year, where we had three races so far, every single one of them has been a learning exercise in looking at what is working well, what has room for improvement. So to give you a very simple example that will illustrate this, the computer that we were using originally, which is the same for all the team, we literally have the same GPU, same compute power available. It was not designed to be like automotive grade. Forget racing grade. It wasn't even an automotive grade computer. And what that meant was there was a risk that when you were in these triple digit miles per hour speeds, the vibrations were causing sort of, some issues with the reliability of the CAN bus or the PCI Express parts of the computer, because they were never meant to be operated in this environment. So everybody recognized this as a safety critical issue. And now we have a new computer for this season, which is rugged. It's duty tested for, it's spec'd at some very, very high vibrations. And so collectively, the cars have also improved from last year so that you have a better chance of easy repair. The body panels, the carbon fiber is easy to repair. All the suspension bits are easy to repair, just as if it was human racing. And the ruggedness and the robustness of the autonomy bits and the sensors has also improved with similar experiences like the one with the computer I just shared.
You mentioned that this is, there's lots of research questions at play right now. What are some of the other areas of research that you're learning about?
Right. So. In my case, my group here at UVA, we really conduct research on robotics and AI. That's the high-level umbrella under which I operate. And the most visible applications of both of them is autonomous driving, and the most safety critical as well. And so very naturally, I have a lot of research done on safety of autonomous vehicles, just passenger autonomous vehicles. And I feel that racing has a lot to offer to that equation of how we can improve the overall safety. I'll give you a very sort of tangible way that I foresee this playing out. And for that, I have to go back in time once more, but this time we'll go all the way back, right? So there was a time when we were transitioning from horse-driven carriages to horseless carriages, and there was mistrust in the public that this technology is not safe, it's unreliable, this engine can blow up in my face, this is a tank of hot oil or something, and the brakes will not apply. And that was one of the reasons that the automotive industry started hosting these endurance races or these races in Paris in the sort of the late 19th century. And so that was the birth of motorsport racing to kind of build this trust to show what the technology is capable of and that it is safe at the end of the day. And then every single improvement we take for granted in our SUVs and sedans that we drive somehow has an origin somewhere in racing, whether it's rear view mirrors, it's seat belts, it's material science, better brakes, what have you. And so now we are at a very similar transition in the history of mobility. We are transitioning this time for driver-driven carriages to driverless carriages. And so there is a similar mistrust, there's similar skepticism that how are we going to show that this is safe enough, right? So and the industry is taking an approach where they are slowly testing and deploying and learning from internally where the mistakes are. But then I believe motorsport has a similar role to play. We are using racing again as a basis to show what are the limits of this technology. If you can run a race car at 180, 150 miles per hour with 10 other race cars, all autonomous, then surely you can manage the chaos of regular passenger freeway driving. That's just one high-level way of thinking about it. But more coherently, one problem with regular driving is what we call, they have to operate in a certain operational design domain. Think of that as this is the terms of agreement, and if your environment conditions are within this safety blanket or ideal operating conditions, go ahead, flip the button and let it run autonomous, unsupervised. But if it is raining or if the traffic is very unstructured, then you have to sort of, not operate in autonomous mode. And so racing is very good for testing cases where you have a highly uncertain movement of other agents, so very highly dynamic, uncertain environments. And so my research is planning to show or aims to show that what you can learn from expert maneuvering in racing will ultimately segue into passenger self-driving and improve the ability of a self-driving car to deal with unexpected traffic situations. Right now, these cars on a good day will go at 35 miles per hour or 50 miles per hour, but our cars, we exit pit lane at 90, 70 miles per hour. And so the intent here is not that, regular cars should weave through traffic and race on the streets. Nobody is advocating for that. But the intent is that regular cars should also know the limits of their braking, the limits of their steering, the limits of if they had to swerve, which is a very, last resort option, they are at least capable of doing that. And there are some many, many other immediate things which are already noteworthy and can be, incorporated as well, which is like a better understanding of the dynamics of a vehicle, not even a race car, right? So the teams are developing better models for handling vehicle behavior at the limits, which is equivalent to saying what happens to vehicle dynamics if you are running on a slick road and which is an ice layer on it, or it's raining, the images of the camera are blurred for some reason. That's what racing is. Racing offers us the unusual all the time. And so whatever we do to fix that, ultimately or eventually will have some bearing on safety of passenger vehicles. So that's the sort of the research threads. Multiple of those exist today. And that's why it's this competition is great, because it allows us to align research with very real world impact, with a very unique opportunity for students to do this experiential learning that otherwise would be impossible behind a PowerPoint. And then it's also, I like to believe, it's also somewhat inspirational for emerging young scientists who look at this and say, hey, you know, it's not all just, video games and simulation. This is real world racing. And I get to see what I coded up last night literally overtake my opponent on track. And that to me will always remain like the coolest bit of this. Yeah.
How many students are on the Virginia race team, and are there other partners that you work with on your team? I know some of the other teams are not just from a single school, but multiple schools working together.
Yeah, so the team composition is all over the place. You will see a lot of different mixes in pit lane. In my particular case, we started with a very small team of just 7 students. This is literally how we started in the first phase of the competition. And now I have 18 students who are part of this team. A lot of them are PhD and master students who are doing their graduate research in this particular area. But then I work with a lot of undergraduate students as well. They are engineering heavy because, you know, this is a engineering heavy discipline. So, but there is room to have, other students involved as well. And they're not all confined to computer science, but majority of them are from computer science or electrical and computer engineering, but we have, people who are experts in sort of vehicle dynamics from the mechanical and aerospace background as well. I have a student who used to work for a NASCAR team, and now he's my in-house racing expert because we are trying to encode the brain of a racing driver into our algorithms the best we can. And so I think my team is on like the mid-size. We have other teams which are 40 students and above, and some teams which are still single digit. And so every team, has their own constraints, their own resources. So UVA is just all Virginia team. We don't have a partnership with another university, but we do, have industry helping us in terms of supporting the team and offsetting some of the costs to run the team as well. So we have sponsorships which help us out in that regard. Yeah.
In terms of what you mentioned before about safety and expecting the unexpected, I'm wondering how the race cars do, and maybe this is something they've improved on from race one through today. How do they do at evaluating the behavior of the other car on the track and determining if that car is doing something that is safe or not? I mm-hmm. foresee that could be something that'd be very useful in the real world of autonomy on public streets someday.
Right. And let me tell you, Pete, you have hit upon what I consider as one of the weakest links in any kind of autonomous driving today, is to have confidence in your ability to predict what others are going to do, because that's what eventually drives your own plan and your own trajectory literally on the track. Let's chat a little bit about how the competition has evolved. The very first race was held in form of a time trial. So one car at a time, 2.5 mile oval in Indianapolis, go as fast as possible. You get some warm-up laps to build some heat into the tires, because these tires like to sit in a certain temperature zone before you can push them like crazy. And then you have 2 laps to go as fast as possible, but there's just one car. So this was literally, as a viewer, it may seem, what's the big deal? It's just one car, how difficult it can be. Well, let me tell you, it's very difficult to have that car operate fully autonomously. There's so many things that can go wrong. It has to figure out where it is precisely on the track, hundreds of times a second. It has to rely on its LiDAR and other sensors to not try to hit a wall. And so it's not choreographed. It's all autonomous. We are not allowed to send any signals to the car. So this is literally kind of level 4 operation, because it's constrained to a racetrack. These are not street legal vehicles, but it's fully autonomous, right? And then the car also avoided some static obstacles as a test for collision avoidance. And then once it has kept track of itself, it's responding to radio signals, just like you would have marshals waving yellow flag, green flag, red flag on a real racetrack. Here, we don't need marshals. We just send a radio signal to tell the status of the track. And then through those radio signals, the car knows when to come into the pits, when to slow down, what race line to take. But having just one car on the track is relatively easy than having two cars, which is what the next race was. So last year we had a race where we had two cars, but since this was the first time in history we had two cars head-to-head, fully autonomous, it was still, you know, not, it was still, the safety was kind of baked into the rules. So the defender, so to speak, the defender vehicle was always restricted to be on one half of the track. So you weren't allowed to really defend your position. You had to commit to one side of the track so that if an attacker was to overtake autonomously, you know, they wouldn't unexpectedly see you veer in and kind of, you know, T-bone from the side. And so it was baked in a little bit to make sure that you actually had a decent chance of overtaking. And so the rules specify, you know, that what lateral and longitudinal spacing has to be maintained when you are in the vicinity of another car. And all teams have to first figure out where the other car is using their sensors. So most teams use a combination of LiDAR, radar for long range, and camera, and a fusion of them to figure out where the opponent is. But just knowing where the opponent is not enough. You have to have a prediction of the opponent's trajectory as well. So in the first time we did head-to-head racing, that piece was not super critical because the opponent wasn't allowed to change their race line. But now in the race that you will witness in early January, on January 7th, that has been relaxed to what humans do, right? So you will have a defender which could be taking its own line. It's still not allowed to weave about, just like a human driver. You know, there's a gentleman's agreement that you cannot just go in a sinusoidal wave on the middle of the track. And that's unsafe. So, but it's relaxed. Now the opponent can take any line of their choosing. And so that element where you have to predict where they will be in the next half a second or 1 second becomes very, very important. And a lot of, you know, development of my team has gone into that neural network and infrastructure to predict where the opponent will be. And we do so using data that we collected from our previous races and replaying our new algorithms on top of that. So we can recreate what happened last year and then evaluate and assess how would our autonomous stack work in that exact situation if we had to predict the opponent as well. So yes, this is one of the biggest challenges, even with passenger driving, to have a reliable prediction. And this is where what I said earlier about highly dynamic situations, the definition of these situations is when your prediction is not accurate. So what do you do then? Then you have to brake hard or swerve hard. And then again, you need to know how to do that as well. Yep.
This feels a lot like the DARPA challenges of 20 years ago at this point, maybe not quite 20 years, 15 years ago, let's say.
Right.
But to your point about racing being a proving ground, is this the continuation of what DARPA started essentially?
I like to believe that. I think it's not DARPA funded, but that's not important. But, you know, it is in the very much the same spirit, right? So this is, in my opinion, the grand challenge to kind of push forward and establish and demonstrate that what does it take to have technology which will be safe in these crazy situations. And, you know, I'll be the first to say that, you know, the racetrack looks nothing like a street in New York or San Francisco, right? The kind of perception problems our car is solving is not the same. We don't expect pedestrians or pets or cyclists on the racetrack. But what we gain in the simplicity of the situation, we lose because of the speeds at which we are operating. So the kind of technologies I see emerging from the India Autonomous Challenge, which already I have seen glimpses of, are going to be efficient ways of doing things with you know, minimal amount of compute effort to detect multiple cars in camera images, which are very blurred because of motion blur at these speeds, to be able to localize with radar when you don't have enough samples to do a lot of compute. Because in racing, you don't have the luxury of time that you have in regular driving. So think of this as, you know, you have a regular self-driving autonomous layer which should exist on every car. And then you have on top of that some sort of a supervisory control there that will make sure that this passenger car is good to go at the peripheries of its operational design domain. And it has some graceful way of dealing with edge situations, right? So no one, including myself, can claim oh, this vehicle has seen all possible situations. That's just never going to occur. So what you can hope for is when something does occur, what does your car do? Is it just going to slam the brakes and hope for the best? Is it going to slow down and pull over? Is that always possible? So we are trying to explore and first of all, you know, increase that envelope of environment situations where you would be allowed to drive autonomously with confidence, and also help in the situations which are non-ideal for driving, right? So when the road is slick, when you don't have good quality camera data, when your LiDAR is, you know, not reliable or damaged even, those are the situations which require the most top drawer algorithms, which we aim to develop. Right?
We're going to take a short break from my conversation with Madhur for this word from our sponsor. When we return, Madhur is going to discuss some of his work across robotics, and we're going to talk more about why he thinks his team has an edge in this week's Indy Autonomous Challenge.
Every year, about 43,000 lives are lost on U.S. roadways. Continental is working to reduce that number to zero through advanced safety technologies that are available right now. Nearly 10,000 lives could be saved every year, and 1.1 million injuries could be prevented if currently available safety technologies existed on every vehicle. The technology is already here to help you get safely there. From lane departure warning systems to emergency brake assist, today's advanced driver assistance systems provide the building blocks for the automated driving of the future. Continental is using its full innovative prowess to drive this trend and develop intelligent technologies that assist the driver in critical situations. The advantage? Increased safety, more convenience, and greater efficiency.
Hi, I'm Lizzie O'Leary, host of Slate's What Next TBD, a clear-eyed look at technology, power, and the future. From fake news to fake meat, algorithms to augmented reality, we'll guide you through the rapid technological changes that are reshaping our world. Those changes aren't always visible, and they aren't always what they appear to be. That's where TBD comes in. With the help of expert guests, we'll help you parse out what matters, what doesn't, and what's next. Subscribe to What Next TBD in your favorite podcast app.
Now back to my conversation with University of Virginia professor Madhur Behl. When autonomous vehicles are operating in these challenging conditions, or we'll call them less than ideal conditions, or maybe even a minimal risk condition, something goes wrong and it now needs to kind of gracefully exit the highway or pull to the shoulder. You know, we've heard a lot about the developments and challenges that we've seen throughout the industry from, and I'm curious from your perspective, like how ready are the autonomous vehicles that are operating on public roads today to be doing so?
Yeah, I mean, it's a, you know, I have a very like informed opinion on this, because this is, I keep tabs on everything which is happening. And first of all, like not a week goes by before you hear a new deployment or a new demo. And sadly, nowadays, we also hear about companies scaling back, because slowly there is a realization that this is a very, very difficult problem. It's a problem in artificial general intelligence, right? Because driving is a very, very intelligible task. And so to do it well for all situations requires big breakthroughs. And so many companies are realizing that it was not a good idea to overpromise at the very beginning. And now what I see in terms of readiness is, first of all, a lot of progress has been made, right? So you have to give credit where credit is due. Building upon the advances in deep learning, in GPU technology, and better control, better hardware, better sensors, cheaper sensors. I mean, these, you know, the deployments I see on the West Coast and in other parts of the country, they are very impressive. You know, they can deal with a lot of situations, but at the same time, it's very transparent that they're not ready for, you know, prime time. Right? This is not, you know, if you're not one of the early adopters, if you are an average American today, you would think twice before just, you know, sending your kids to school in one of these completely unsupervised, or you're having it come and fetch your grandparents for Christmas Eve, right? So we are not quite there yet, because the technology is very difficult, right? With the last 10% of the situations that it has to respond to, it will take additional kind of 80%, 90% of effort. So from someone like myself, who is in academia, who's mostly doing research, I appreciate the kind of the engineering rigor that has gone into producing a product that is somewhat, you know, deployable, at least in testing phase. But I do also fear that there is maybe a risk where the pace of the deployment might be exceeding the rate at which the safety of these vehicles is getting improved, right? So we are kind of maybe deploying them too fast. And then my other concern is that the safety of these vehicles is not auditable today at all, right? So the kind of metrics that I see are very high level of total miles driven or disengagements per mile. I mean, this is, you know, even worse than what you see in a non-safety critical software. So what I would hope is a way to gather more trust is, you know, share tangible data where these are really the most technologically advanced vehicles, which can gather so much information about what they are doing, what others were doing. And so, you know, I understand completely that all these industry players, they want to protect their secret sauce. By the way, everyone is using some mix of perception, planning, control, right? So it's just how well they are doing each piece. But what I would hope as an you know, outsider looking into this industry is some more measurable data, you know, some sensor data. We don't care, you know, specifically about what algorithms your vehicle is using, but even if you share sensor data on, you know, why your vehicle hit the curb on this intersection, why did it not yield to this vehicle, that is where collectively the entire industry will move forward, right? It's kind of drawing a parallel with the aviation industry. So any crash by any airline is bad for the entire industry, not just for one particular aviation manufacturer. So that common fate, that common sense of you know, collective improvement lacks, in my opinion, in the autonomous vehicle industry today. And I know it's not easy to fix, and I'm making it sound like an ideal world problem, but the closer we can get to that, it will go a long way in advancing this last 10% of the challenge which remains in really making sure that these cars, which have the potential to save 40,000 lives a year, become a reality, right? So why not work together on this as what someone like myself will advocate to the industry.
Adhur, you mentioned that you are a research scientist, and you know, the things that you have looked into span autonomous vehicles, robotics, AI, and there's also a component of your previous work that looks at maritime and flooding in coastal cities. So I want to totally switch gears here and ask you about that. And then also how you have the time to kind of research this wide scope of very pressing issues.
Oh boy, you really did your homework, Peter. I must say I'm very impressed that you are even aware of this other universe within which I operate. So I'll try to make as plausible a case for why I do that, but I don't know if I'll succeed in it. In a nutshell, you know, the what I have realized is the potential of many of these fields. They are, for the lack of a better term, stuck in their ways. And, you know, not for the better or the worse, but they haven't been able to adapt or evolve to utilize the entire infrastructure and data that is plausible in case of flooding, for instance, right? So this is a real risk, right? So what good is it making autonomous vehicles if there are no roads to run autonomous vehicles on and all the cities are under sea level? And I try to, you know, do a lot of interdisciplinary research, and I just don't claim that I'm doing it. Robotics itself is very interdisciplinary, but this is really crossing a different bridge because I sit together with hydrologists, with civil engineers, and understand really, you know, why is it that we don't have a real-time flood prediction model for these coastal cities? Like in Virginia, we have a city called Norfolk, which has a high flood risk. There's New Orleans, which has a high flood risk in the U.S., and now we have cities on the West Coast as well. So the technology, in my opinion, exists today for this to be possible, but it requires a bridging of the minds. It requires literally, you know, the very definition of interdisciplinary research. So, you know, the ways they used to predict and build these forecasting models was physics-based or using first principles, which is very useful, but unfortunately, it's very cost and time prohibitive. It's very expensive to build this. Like, it will cost you millions of dollars to build this for one neighborhood in one city. And so we can do better. We have radar data. We have crowdsourced. People have personalized weather stations. You know, in the future, when you have a self-driving car with a LiDAR, it can detect the depth of flood on the road. And so it's going to give me data, and we can build a very, very reliable, high fidelity flood map of a city, which can be used for real time traffic control, for real time planning, and even disaster recovery situations. So absolutely, you know, while my first love is AI and AI, the embodiment of AI, which is robotics, I do care about how this fits in the larger scheme of things. And in terms of time, I don't have an answer to that, but yeah, I mean, you know, I spend time on it because this is what excites me, and I think this is worth spending time on because it's a problem that needs attention from people who are not traditionally in civil engineering or hydrology to come and share a different perspective, to learn about this other discipline in engineering and policy and regulation. That's, I think, what it takes, right? So someone has to do it, and I'm willing to spend time to figure it out.
Very interesting. Final question for you here as we wind down, and I'll bring it back to the India Autonomous Challenge here. You mentioned earlier that each team gets the exact same car in terms of performance and engine and hardware. What is it that gives your team the edge heading into the India Autonomous Challenge event in Las Vegas, January 7th?
Okay, so I think it's not a difficult question, because I think what has happened is we crashed last year in the middle of an overtake. So, you know, we went down fighting, but we decided that we will, you know, live to race another day and come back. And this is what I hope I get to demonstrate, and we get to demonstrate in January. I hope that the students really get a chance to demonstrate all the hard work they have put in. And the answer is not some clever new mousetrap that we have figured out. It's improvements all across the board, right? So our perception, instead of detecting the opponent at 60 meters, now we can, you know, pick them up at 100 meters out, because we have just improved our perception, our fusion algorithms for looking at how much uncertainty is within every single detection, of, you know, getting rid of the noise. So it's that sort of a, you know, three level deep exercise of figuring out why is it not working at full range, and then how to make it faster as well. There's a massive change in my team where our software is not some monolithic piece of code. It's runs in, you know, a virtual container, Docker containers. So it's very modular, and we can pick and choose based on some situation what module. And at the end of the day, I think this is true for all the teams, but especially this is how our team approaches this. It's somewhat poetic and philosophical that no matter how much you compute and do, at the end of the day, a race car is about how the tires make contacts with the track. That's what it boils down to, which is the most non-compute thing you can think of, but that's what it is, right? That's the same for a human driver. It's the same for an AI. So we spend a lot of energy and thought on modeling tire behavior, getting data from our previous runs to understand the limits of traction that our vehicle has going to have when we go on a banked track, which is, you know, 25 degrees banked in Vegas. And so we have to know what the limit of the lateral acceleration on that rubber is at what temperature. So these are the levels of modeling and details which have gone into understanding how can we actually get the most performance of the race car. And then the last piece is having confidence in your software. What do I mean by that is that we trust my car that if something were to go wrong, if some part of the code crashes, or if some data quality drops or some signal drops, we trust our car to come to a safe stop on its own without supervision. And this gives the team the confidence to push the car, because we know that, okay, we have thought about all these contingencies. If something happens, this is how our code operates, and the car will come to what we call a graceful stop. And this is actually, at the end of the day, you know, what drives every team, how confident they are in the car's ability to handle what could arise, and we will see what could arise in January. I hope we get to see a good race. I hope we don't crash our car. I have to say that too. But if we do crash it, you know, we are going there either to win or to learn. That's how we look at it, right? So either outcome is very much invited and welcomed. But I really hope that all the students, not just my team, get to show the world what they are capable of, what autonomous racing can hold for the future of safe autonomous driving. And I'm pretty sure the industry and others who are watching, you know, they would want some of these students to come and work for them, because this is really the top talent in autonomy that you have on pit lane in Vegas. Yeah. So I hope many of the listeners who are listening can join us as well. And I hope to see you, Pete, at the racetrack as well.
I will definitely be there. And I was looking to it before this conversation, and even more so now. So should be a great event. Thank you, Madhur, for making the time to come talk about the India Autonomous Challenge today. And we will see you in Las Vegas.
Excellent. I hope to see you as well. And thanks again for inviting me for this very, very insightful discussion.
When Omicron struck a year ago, I was among the crowd that canceled plans to attend CES at the last minute. I was bummed to miss out on the India Autonomous Challenge race then. So really looking forward to it this year after a long wait. Again, we're going to have extensive coverage of the India Autonomous Challenge and everything else at CES. You can find that throughout the week at autonews.com. That is it for today's episode. If you'd like the conversation, please give us a like or subscribe to the Shift Podcast at Apple, Stitcher, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you again to Madhur. Thank you for listening. We'll be back next week.